Hey there, and thank you for tuning in to Crosshairs Radio, episode 26. On today's show, we have Arlie Kemmerer. Arlie Kemmerer, who started her own team, Level 11 Racing, also started her own law practice. Yeah, that's right. She is a full-time lawyer, full-time bike racer, fits it all into one lifetime. Pretty amazing. It was great to catch up with Arlie. I've known her for a long time since when she started really getting into cyclocross when she was in law school down in DC in the mid-2000s, and it's been fun to follow her career since then. What else can I tell you? Wide Angle Podium Network. That's what we're on right now. That's where Crosshairs Radio is on. Go check out wideanglepodium.com. We'd love you to become a member. Donate to your favorite shows that are on that network. You know, shows like the Slow Ride Podcast. Just finished recording an episode of Kids Don't Follow Podcast. That's the music podcast I do with my friends Taylor and Elliot. So go check that out. They are also on the Wide Angle Podium Network. And it's a cool thing. You know, and we'd love to get your support for that. That's pretty much it. Enjoy this conversation. I think it's a good one. Here is Arlie. Oh, one last thing. During our conversation, Arlie's talking about racing at Hoogerheide, and I may have referred to that as a Belgian race, and I know it's in the Netherlands, and it's a Dutch race, so I apologize for that. You don't have to tweet me about it. Okay, let's talk to Arlie. So Arlie, how's it going?
It is going well.
Good. Well, thanks for joining us here on Crosshairs Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I just want to, I think a lot of people out there know who you are, especially East Coast and Northeast and then even Mid-Atlantic where you started. But, you know, others out there may not, even though you were on the USA Cycling Worlds team for a number of years and had a great career up to this point, starting your own team and doing a lot of cool stuff. But I'd love to go back and just get into it with you, how you got into bike racing to start with. I know that it wasn't your first athletic pursuit.
It was not my first athletic pursuit. I was a downhill ski racer for basically my whole life. From the time I was like 10 years old on, and I ended up, in order to pursue it, I ended up going to a ski academy in Vermont. So I grew up in Pennsylvania. I still live there now, but we're not known for our ski racing here. So I went to a ski academy in Vermont for high school. I actually went to KMS before they even had a cycling program. So it's really funny to see them around now. So that's kind of a neat connection. And then I went to the University of New Hampshire to race Division I. Downhill ski racing. And it was actually at UNH. They had a club cycling team, and it was something really simple. Like, you pay $100, you get this jersey, and you can go to any race that you want to go to. And I had always like kind of been a fan of cycling, like just watching it on TV. And my parents and I would ride bikes. Like, we were mountain biking from the time I was really young, just as like a family thing. But never really considered racing until that point. My dad bought me a road bike as a graduation gift when I was a senior in high school. And I was like, well, that's cool. And I would like do like some short rides, but nothing major. And then I actually got a stress fracture in college my junior year, because I used to run all the time. I ran cross country and used to distance run just for fitness. And I don't know why, because I didn't like it, but I wasn't built to be a runner at all either. But
it probably wasn't helping you much in downhill skiing.
It was not. Actually, people always thought I was a Nordic skier at UNH. They because I was always doing endurance sports, and they would be like, oh, you're on the downhill team. It happened all the time. So maybe I should have been a Nordic skier. That's my real calling. I don't know. But I got a stress fracture in my shin, so all I could do was ride a bike. So my roommate and I started riding more as opposed to running, and then my senior year when skiing was over, I was like, well, maybe I'll just try this cycling thing because it's like the only time I'm ever going to have any idea how to get into it.
So did you have any aspirations skiing wise of being a pro skier? Was that the goal?
Skiing is a really weird sport. Like it's probably more akin to like gymnastics and things like that. Like they take you onto the US ski team when you're like 16. Like that's when you kind of get picked up for the development team and you're taken through the rest of your high school life with the US ski team. And if you get to the point where you're racing in college, the chances are you've like, that's sort of like your slow retirement.
Okay.
And we had a lot of people. Like I had teammates at UNH that were on the US ski team and had only maybe made it up to like the C team level. They have four different levels, and then raced collegiate. So it was sort of like, I never had been that good to make the US ski team. Like I was pretty competitive, but, I actually used to ski race with Leah Davison. Her and I were competitive on snow.
Yeah. Well, I talked to Ellie Anderson earlier in the year. And that was sort of her sport as well. And it seemed like she was on that, you know, and then she got injured and then, you know, found bike. So it's interesting. You're, you know, the second downhill skier into cyclocross that I've talked to. What do you think?
Amy Dombrowski was a downhill ski racer also.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So what do you think? And I've asked, you know, these other folks that as well. What do you think skill-wise you brought over from skiing that helped you out in cycling?
I think it's a huge advantage that I actually never even realized until I started teaching cyclocross clinics, the ones that we used to do down in DC.
I know. Well, it was funny because if you didn't bring this up, this was the story I was going to bring up. Yeah.
The time we did those like off-camera turns.
We'll continue.
You're trained in ski racing to always be looking ahead because you can't be looking at the turn that you're at. You have to be looking a gate or two ahead of you to be able to anticipate where you're going to start your next turn. And the timing in ski racing is everything. Where you start your turn, when you start your turn, is critical to the success of your run, because in ski racing, people are winning by 1/100th of a second. So that's nothing. That's no time at all. So every little movement you make counts for a lot. And I think I had just become so trained to look ahead, look at the terrain in front of me and know when to turn and know what to be looking at on the ground surface in front of me to know where I wanted to put my wheel, just like where I wanted to put my skis. And I think that was really huge, and understanding the mechanics, the physics of turning, not a thing that I would have thought necessarily would parlay into this, but I even notice when I go mountain biking now, like I can see the most acute things on the ground, and my brain picks it up right away and it's like, you can't ride there. And that's totally from ski racing, because ski racing is like, the conditions are always different. Like, even though you're on the same trail, the weather makes it different. The snow conditions make it different. The visibility makes everything different. So you're doing a lot of things on skis that you can't really see. You have to feel the terrain underneath you as opposed to seeing where you're going.
Yeah.
And I think that's been really helpful.
Yeah. And I think it's also something that you see with people who come over from road cycling into mainly mountain biking, that, you know, road cycling, you can get away with just putting your head down and going. And with mountain bike, which I'm assuming is similar to what you're saying, is you really need to have your head up all the time and looking ahead. You're looking far ahead up the trail to see what you're going to do next. And then your body just sort of follows.
Right. And that's a skill that a lot of people don't. And I sort of took that for granted. And I started learning from teaching these clinics that is not a thing that people innately do. They look at where they want to turn. And they look at a thing that they don't want to hit, and their body goes where they're looking, and they don't realize, you know, how those two concepts combine to get you into a position you don't actually want to be into. So it's been, ski racing definitely has a lot of similarities, especially to mountain biking and cyclocross, in so many more ways than I ever would have thought.
Yeah, I think the other big thing that I've sort of noticed from in just watching skiers is how you're able to control basically from your hips down, the lower half of your body, and transferring that control over to a bike, it seems like you're already sort of one with the bike when you're riding it, when you have that experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally accurate. That's how you teach. That's how, like, you teach the mechanics of skiing and ski racing, is that your lower half of your body does something totally different than your upper half. And to be comfortable with that. So yeah, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, no, the story I remember with when you were teaching those clinics, which was awesome, and you know, it'd be great for you to come down and help us out with that again in the future. But it was a bit of a downhill, not too bad. I mean, for anybody experienced, wouldn't be anything, but there were these beginner women and who were looking down this descent and getting a little freaked out, and you, I think, who are used to much larger descents, were like, well, you just ride it, you just let it go and you ride down, and they're like, how? Yeah. No, it was funny to watch you sort of work with them to get over that fear.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot all about that until just now talking to you about it. But yeah, I like sort of, you know what though, here's the thing. When you teach clinics like that, you have to just be real casual about that stuff, because people will do it if you don't make a big deal about it.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's absolutely right. Yeah, it's a good approach. So I guess starting racing probably just like for the fun of it during college, and then were you mainly just on the road? How did you get off the road and get onto dirt?
Yeah, so I did a whole ECCC season on the road only. And I actually went to Exeter Cycles in New Hampshire. That was the bike shop that sponsored the UNH team. And there was a cyclocross bike sitting there. And I had never seen one before. And I was like, what is that thing? And they're like, oh, that's this thing called cyclocross. And I was like, I've never heard of that. And they're like, oh, you have to race cyclocross. You're in New England. Like, this is a thing that we do here. And I'm like, well, I don't even know what it is. So they ended up telling me about it. And then I actually just bought a bike. Like, I just sort of got my dad to convince my dad to buy a cross bike. And I bought this Redline Conquest Pro in 2006.
That was the bike to have.
It was. And didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about, like, mounting, dismounting. And so Ryan Kelly, the famous guy on the internet, I went to college with him. He loves the story too.
Yeah,
he was
great.
One of my teammates. And he took me out to this farm where they had, like, training cyclocross races, and taught me how to, like, mount and dismount my bike and, like, do all this stuff. And this was, like, wild. This was a wild concept to me, but I just, like, really took to it. And I was like, this is really cool. And just, like, entered some races just to, like, figure it out. But, like, it went, like, I took to it really naturally. Like, the races were just, like, I evolved pretty quickly through that scene. But I was also racing. So I lived in DC at that time. I moved down there in 2007 to start law school, and raced for, that's when I was racing for Hub Racing for Sean Bega.
Sure.
So I raced like two seasons of pro road, if you want to call it pro road. And I was focused on road. And then he just was kind of like, hey, we'll give you a bike if you want to keep racing for Hub during cross season. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Like, and so Sean's really funny because he's such an interesting guy. He's a very eclectic individual, but he was really, like, he really believed in me as a bike racer in ways that I didn't even understand yet. And so he really sort of kept saying to me, like, I think you can be really good at this. So let's get you into this. Let's get you into that. And so he just kind of gave me that support to go race cross. And, like, I went to nationals in Kansas City and just sort of kept, like, moving up the ranks and just sort of kept at it and thought that was more fun than racing road, and started to sort of transition. I did both for a while and then started to kind of focus more on cross. I would say probably like 2011-ish, 2010.
Sure.
Something like that.
So how did you get, Sean Bega, or I mean, Bega, Sean. Now I'm even blanking on his real last name. But
Blumenfeld.
Yeah.
Everybody knows his Bega. You don't need to know his last name.
but he's an interesting story because he just, you know, he's was a messenger at the time, still does a little bit of that, had his hand in a lot of other things, and started this legitimate racing team. How did you get hooked up into that scene and start racing with Hub?
So when I knew I was moving to DC to go to law school, I was like, well, I need to get on a club team down there because I didn't know anybody there. I didn't know anywhere to ride. I knew nothing. Like, I was totally cold to Washington, DC. I think the only time I had been there was like on a junior high National Honor Society field trip. So I knew nothing about the place at all. And I was just Googling cycling teams in DC, and Hub came up, and it was like this like pro team, and Brooke O'Connor raced on the team that year, and she was like featured in, I think, in Bicycling Magazine. So I was like, wow, this is like a big deal. And so that became my goal. Like, I want to get on this team. And I just started, I must have found either Sean's contact or Sheba Farron's contact, and just was persistent. Like, hey, like, I want to ride with you guys. Like, I want to be on your team, you know, like, here's my resume. And they let me guest ride a couple times, and then they brought me onto the team in 2008, I guess. And so it was just like, it was me being persistent, maybe annoying. I don't know.
And, you know, not to gloss over, you were doing this while also going to law school, which is a big time investment. So I've talked to people now who are really a lot who are living this dual life, especially women, where, you know, it's tough to be a full-time cyclocross racer, as you can attest to, and we'll get to later. So how did you find that time to sort of balance between doing any training and being on a race team and then also going to law school at the same time?
I get that question a lot, and actually not as much as I used to. When I was in school and shortly thereafter, I would get messages from all kinds of people asking me this, like Facebook messages about it. And I actually think it made it easier to get through law school because my routine was so regimented. It was like, I go to school at this time on this day, and then I come home and I ride at this time, and then I study for this subject at this time. And it was just like very, I mean, I had like a schedule like mapped out of how I was going to study for torts at 7 o'clock on Monday, 7 to 8. Like, it was probably overkill, but I mean, it worked, I guess.
Yeah,
but
no, I think that's right. I actually found that a similar thing. And it's almost now when I have a lot more things to do, but they're not as regimented like that, that it's harder to get them done when you almost know that there's that limited amount of time, and, you know, you have your goals and you have to do them.
Yeah, I mean, that was exactly it. Like, I have 2 hours to ride on this day, so I have to do it now or else it's not going to happen at all. And it was good because it gave me like a multidimensional purpose. I think, at least I encountered in my law school experience, I've made some of my best friends at law school, but I've also met a lot of people that I was so incredibly different from because I had an identity independent of becoming a lawyer. And I think a lot of people go to law school looking to get their identity out of becoming a lawyer. And so I did not fit the mold of your typical law school student. So I got really good grades because I studied a lot, and I was determined when they, you know, that speech they give you, like, look to your right, look to your left, you're not going to see these people in 3 years. Like, I was determined that that was not going to be me. And so, but I didn't need to, like, I was already a bike racer. I already had these other sort of like things about me, and this was just going to be another dimension to my life. And I mean, like, you remember when the big deal is to make law review.
Right.
And I made it and I didn't care. I was like, well, this is like, it didn't identify me. And like, other people were like clawing at each other to try to get onto this law review thing. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't feel like I need, like, resume boosters are great, but it's not going to identify me. I'm just not going to let it do that. And some of my best friends out of law school were similar in that regard. Like, I'm going to be a lawyer, but like, I was also in the Peace Corps, and now my best friend lives in Micronesia right now, and he's practicing law there. So so being a cyclist was like another, it was good. It was a different outlet, and it gave me like something else to focus on in addition to the pressures of like studying and dealing with like all the stress associated with law school. Is a really good outlet.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that is definitely important. And yeah, we both have friends who, you know, you look at them and they're in firms and it's awesome and they're making a tons of money, but I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to switch places with them. They also are there for 80 hours a week or whatever, and it doesn't seem like a ton of fun. But
yeah, and that was a big thing because I didn't do any internships in the summer because I wanted to race bikes, and like this was an opportunity that I wasn't going to get forever. And you know, like at the time, they really scare you into, you have to do your internship because this is how you're going to get a job. And if you don't have job experience because you didn't do your internship, and they scared me, but I still was like, no, I'm going to go race my bike because that's a thing I can never do again. And it was the right decision. I also waited to take the bar exam. I took it in February as opposed to July because I didn't want to start studying immediately out of law school. Like the day people walked out of graduation and into bar review. And
graduation was almost the worst because you knew it didn't mean anything. I mean, it was great that you were done with law school, but that's exactly right. It was like there was no sense of relief because, yeah, you're absolutely right. 2 days later, you know, you got your stack of Barbary books and then that's all you were doing for the whole summer.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to come back to Pennsylvania. A really good friend of mine owns a gym that I still work out at. Actually, I was teaching spinning there tonight, right before I came here or came home. I worked for her and bike raced. So I did a whole cross season in 2010, the 2010-2011 season, without having anything else going on. And that was the first time that I had really ever raced bikes without some kind of other really stressful event going on. And took the bar in February. I took the New Jersey and PA bar at the same time on my birthday, and I passed both of them on the first try. So it was the right move for me.
Yeah. So, and you talk about your racing career really up until, you know, just looking at where you were racing up until that 2010, you were hanging around the Mid-Atlantic doing the series that I'm now the director of, you know, used to be Mabracross and sort of maybe going up north a little bit, but weren't taking it, you know, you weren't going out to all these UCI races, almost like that was sort of training camp for you for those couple years in cyclocross.
Yeah, I did some, like I would do like driving distance UCI races, but yeah, like I stuck mostly to the Mid-Atlantic, like went up to the, you know, like the Gloucester and Providence because that's just what you're supposed to do. And went to nationals, but yeah, you could get a really pretty solid season in the Mid-Atlantic without going very far. So I was traveling every weekend more or less, but yeah, just not like I wasn't flying out to Louisville or like Bend or anything like that at that point.
And in that time, you know, looking at like 2009, 2010, getting top 20 at nationals, when did it start to occur to you that, hey, I'm pretty good at this and maybe have higher aspirations in cyclocross?
I raced for C3 for a couple of years, and that was one of those years was when Laura Van Gilder and Dee Dee Winfield were on the team. And that was such a cool experience because, you know, I mean, Laura has a resume a mile long in bike racing. So like she's an obvious, you know, fantastic mentor. And Dee Dee had gone to Worlds, and like, I had remembered watching Dee Dee win Beacon, like when I first got into cross. And Buck was, their first child was still like a little kid because Buck had their daughter on his shoulders and was like walking up the road because Dee Dee had just won and like cheering for Dee Dee. And like the kid was, you know, like on his shoulders. And I was like, wow, that's cool. Like that's a really neat sight to see. And then I became teammates with both of them and it was just like such a huge experience. And I want to say that was probably 2009 or 2010.
Yeah, probably 2010, I'm guessing.
Yeah, maybe. And we went to HPCX. This was the year that we all had those white Star Wars.
Right, yeah.
Halloween kits. So we went to HPCX and we swept the podium. And that was the first time. Actually, Grenogue might have been the first time I was on the podium with them. We swept the podium there and then we swept the podium again at HPCX. And I was like, cool, because the three of us rode together for all of HPCX, and that was like a big thing for me to be able to hold on to Laura and Dee Dee for a majority of the race, which is not a thing I had ever done before. And so having those two be teammates was like always, like it gave me something to chase nonstop all the time. And so that whole season I was chasing the two of them. And I think that's probably when I was like, okay, if I can hang under their wheels, then like, that's a good sign. This is a thing I should pay more attention to now.
Was there anything, I mean, being on the same team with them, especially somebody who, like Laura, who's just, you know, a legend, possibly, you know, arguably one of the best sprinters in American history, and then also can get on a cross course whenever she wants and at least get to the podium, if not win. Did you have any conversations with her about training, about racing that helped?
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved back to PA, I lived not very far away from her. So her and I trained a bunch together, and because I had a lot more free time then. So we trained, we walked our dogs together a lot. We traveled to races a lot. And actually, I think that maybe 2012, we went to Sterling together, and I had never beat her in a cross race and in any race before in my life. And the first day of Sterling, I was with her for like the whole race. And then I didn't, you know, she beat me in a sprint because of course she would beat me in a sprint. And I was like bummed because I knew I didn't really, like, I gave up mentally because I knew how good of a sprinter she was. And I'm like, well, this is Laura Van Gilder. I'm not going to beat her in a sprint. And it came down to that. And I mentally gave up and I lost it, obviously. Like, that's how that stuff goes. And we went out to dinner that night and she was like, you have to learn how to beat me. And she's like, you have to learn what you can do, what your strengths are and what my weaknesses are. And you have to learn how to beat me. And we like kind of debriefed that whole concept, and it was really cool. It was a really cool experience. It's a thing I will never forget, because then the next day we came to the finish line again, to like this, the finishing stretch, and she had dropped me a little bit, and I was like determined, like, I'm going to give it everything I can to try to outsprint you. And she had a couple bike lengths on me going onto the pavement. And I just like unleashed this wild sprint that I don't know where it came from. I'd love to be able to get it back. And I beat her by like in the sprint finish by like next to nothing. The officials actually showed me the finish line camera, the still. Right. I still have it on my phone actually.
Oh, amazing.
To this day.
Nice.
Yeah. And I couldn't believe that it happened. And it was like just the timing of it was so fascinating because I didn't think that conversation with her had that much of an impact, but it did. And her and I actually just talked about this at Grant's Tomb a couple weeks ago. That was, you know, 4 years ago. But she's really good with that stuff. Like, she knows the right way to talk to people about stuff without, like, she won't hand it to you, and she won't, you know, make it easy for you. But she will pick your brain enough to make you think about how to do what you need to do to be able to be a better bike racer. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's great. And I love hearing stories of that, especially from that, you know, from a previous generation trying to help out the next one. But, you know, while you're doing that, you're already done with law school and you've never went to a firm or anything. Did you just start your own practice straight out of law school? Is that did you have any other jobs in between there?
Yeah, I worked for, a judge who actually is still an active judge in my county. I worked for him clerking for like 4 or 5 months. And then I went to work. His wife actually is also an attorney. So I went to work at her practice for a little bit. And she was doing a lot of estate planning and business organizations. And that was pretty much it for the most part. But the judge that I worked for, so I didn't really know what I wanted to do. When I got out of law school, I just figured I would end up doing some kind of civil practice at some kind of civil firm. Nothing really specific. But after I worked for this judge, we have a lot of, and actually I'm sure this is true of many court dockets, but we have a lot of family law cases. And I watched one case where the attorney had just really not done the work for her client. And we as law clerks had picked up on some discrepancies in what her client was testifying to, basically. The woman had relocated to a different state, and you can't relocate when you're subject to a custody order without the approval of the court. And so she had left with her kid to Florida, but was lying and telling the court that she was still here in Pennsylvania. And we could tell that she wasn't. And the attorney for the father just like did such a bad job. She missed all of these like really obvious signs that she could have caught this lady and brought the kid back. And the guy had no contact with his son because of all of this. And I remember watching it and thinking, wow, this is like, this is heavy stuff. Like, family law is really intense because you're changing someone's entire life if you do this right or wrong. And thought like, yeah, I want to practice family law because I want to litigate. I don't want to do transactional work. I want to be in court. And so I started applying to family law practices, but most of the practices around here are just sole practitioners, I think. And I'm sure that's true of most places other than major, you know, like.
Yeah, I think family law, it's pretty hard to have more than two, probably, yeah, attorneys in a practice.
Yeah, it's usually like two or three. And so I couldn't get anybody to hire me because nobody really took associates. And I happened to stumble upon really good office space for a really good price. One of my super good friends up here, her and her husband own this building. He's a chiropractor. And he said to me, well, I have this space upstairs. He renovated this old farmhouse like through and through, and it was beautiful. And he's like, I didn't finish that part of it, but I always thought, you know, like an accountant or an attorney would be in there. He's like, come look at it. He goes, if you want it, you can finish it. I'll give you a rent credit. So my dad and I went to look at it, and I was like, I actually was supposed to go to a job interview that day. And it was the first job interview I would have had, like having passed the bar. And I canceled it because I was like, I want to open my practice here. Like, it felt like that was the right thing to do. And the way everything had sort of fallen into place, it was like, I feel like this is what I should do because it was such a freak thing the way it all happened. So I just threw up my shingle and started practicing family law. And that was in 2012. And
yeah,
I'm still going. So I must be doing something right.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. So with that, and not to, you know, I can see how I had a little experience in that world. And I can only imagine that doing that, and you're working big hours, but being able to train, being able to get out has to be a little bit of solace from what you're doing when you're at your desk.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, and that was another sort of motivator to have my own practice, is it would give me the flexibility to travel and train more than if I was tied to a firm having to work, you know, whatever their billables were going to be for me. And so it's sort of like, well, you're going to take a financial hit right now, but you're going to be able to race bikes. And again, like, this is this opportunity that you only have now. You can't do this when you're 40. You got to do it now. And plus, it gave me the experience that I was really looking for. Like, you can't argue with somebody who's like going to just go for it on their own. I mean, you learn way more in 1 year of running your own law practice than you ever would working for somebody else. But yeah. And so like, I have that flexibility to train, and yeah, I mean, these family law cases are pretty pervasive in my daily life. I mean, I probably stay involved in them more than I should, you know, like after hours getting text messages and emails. And I mean, you're as a family law practitioner, you're not just a lawyer. You're also these people's counselor, their therapist in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, like there's been a couple times where like I've left court and like, you know, had a tough day. I've had a foster family or foster care case where kids got put in foster care and I couldn't get them out. And I kept thinking we'd go every 3 months and I'd think, oh, I'm going to get them out. And I remember one time like being so sure that we had met every criteria we needed and the judge just wouldn't let these kids out. And I like went out to my car and cried on the way home because I just like, I knew everybody wasn't doing their job properly. And that's why this was all happening. And I had no control. I did everything I could do. I put everything into it and it wasn't working. So I don't know that I could do family law for the rest of my career, but I feel like as long as I have the energy, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's pretty rewarding when it works out in the right way.
Yeah, so. But it's also, you know, having those disappointments are all part of the job, and that you are competent in it and passionate in it. You know, you're doing what your clients need. So,
yeah, yeah.
You can only do so much with the system in place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, but part of that drive that you have, and part of sort of not being scared. We even go back to that hill with, you know, being casual about it, or even in law school, you know, serious, but just being able to go and do things. I think that probably led you into being able to say to yourself, hey, I'm no longer, you know, racing with an established team. I'm going to start my own program, and just sort of jumping into that and being able to pull that off. Just talk me through how that happened, and, you know, what you needed to do. 'Cause I think that's a big issue with pros out there today trying to get sponsorship and trying to get support, and you've been able to do that for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that was a real that was a real like jump into the deep end moment. Like, I probably felt like I really jumped in headfirst into the deep end with that more than I felt about opening my law practice. Because that's a real leap of faith in bike racing that it's all going to come together. But I mean, what happened there was I went to the World Championships in 2014 and had everything sort of lined up, like was talking to teams and had those resumes in, and everybody was really interested. And then, you know, it was starting to come down to the wire and everybody's like, you know, like, I don't think we're going to take on another woman or.
Yeah, let's actually back up a little bit and talk about, because we sort of skipped over 2013, which I think was probably your breakout season, you know, winning races on the podium pretty much every week. And then how does it come about that you're start to be noticed by USA Cycling, starting to get the opportunities to go to Europe and sort of making that jump from great regional racer to one of the top national racers?
Well, I think, it might have been in 2012 that in December of 12, or maybe it was December of 13. No, it'd be December of 12. I was going to go to Belgium for Christmas. And so, like, that's like the big holy grail, right? Like, everybody wants to be able to make it into the World Cups for Christmas. And so this was before the top 50 rule. So basically the way USA Cycling did it is they took the top 8 people who were applying to go. So that was it. So like if you were the 9th person in that UCI ranking, then you weren't going. And what happened that year was I was 1 point away from being able to go, and Andrea Smith and I were sort of like jockeying back and forth for that spot. And what happened was the Warwick list, like the way the points came out, Warwick from the year before day 2 was still in the points list, and I didn't think it was going to be. And so because she was still having her Warwick points calculated from the year prior, she was able to make it into Belgium and I couldn't. And so like came down to 2 weeks before the World Cups in December when we knew who was going. And so that was a real bummer because I thought I was going to make it. Like I had run all those calculations and I didn't. So I went to Hoogerheide after Nationals in 2013, because at that point I was like, well, now I need to make the investment to go get more points. Like I maxed out on C2s, hadn't really done a lot of C1 competition. So I was like, well, you know what? Like we had a little bit of budget. So I'm like, I'm just going to go to Hoogerheide, and ended up getting like 15th at that World Cup, which was pretty unexpected, but it was also snowy that year, which it's never been since then. So it was like, you know, the cyclocross guide gods were smiling on me there because I raced really well on snow, obviously. And so like, I went to that race. My dad actually went with me, and he was my pit guy. Never saw a cyclocross race before. So this was great. Like,
that must have been some culture shock for him in that Belgium pit.
Yeah, he just had no idea. It's so funny because like people like kill for that opportunity kind of, and he just was like standing there in the pit in this giant North Face red puffy jacket, so you could see him on the TV feed every time they went past the pit. And he didn't bring gloves with him. He like went there without gloves. So he stood in the pit with no gloves. Fortunately, and Stefan Wyman was also helping me out there. So at least like if anything catastrophic would have happened, you know, like sure, he would have been there. But we didn't need to pit because it was cold and everything was frozen. But I had met Jeff Rowe at that race of Folks Bikes.
Yeah.
And I met him in the airport, actually, at the rent-a-car place, because someone had given me his name as an American contact to get like, you know, go to get the number pickup and stuff. And I just happened to bump into him because he was there with Zach McDonald, and I recognized Zach. And so like he introduced himself to me, and he just was really kind to me and like was really willing to like make sure that I had everything I needed. And like, and it was nice because like he knew like this was my first time there and I'm there with my dad, and I, you know, like, I'm just showing up to race bikes. Like, I don't really know what's going on. And he was pretty – this was when Rafa Focus was still a thing. And I think I had finished either right ahead of Gabby Day or right near her. And so Jeff was sort of, like, struck by that. Like, oh, like, look at this no-named person on this no-name team who just kind of winged it and had a good result. I think I was actually 18th at that race. And so he sort of like followed me kind of behind the scenes. And then when I needed to put my own team together after I went made Worlds in 2014, I sent him a message. I was like, hey, you know, would Focus be interested in sponsoring me if I put my own team together? And he was like, yes, like, you tell me what you need, we'll make it happen.
Oh, that's amazing. He is, yes. He's a great guy and a really, really just such a strong supporter of U.S. cyclocross.
Yeah, he is. And he's like, he's just so awesome in so many ways. And I like, I credit him for so much of what it is that I have now. And he's really like modest about it. Like he won't, like I'll say to him, like, thank you for everything. Like, I mean, I really am indebted to you for this. And he just will, he just kind of shrugs it off. Like he doesn't want to, you know, like he doesn't get sucked into the sappiness of it. It's really funny, but, but he really is like, he really has made, he has connected me with some really great people who have been willing to sort of take the risk on me putting this program together. And like, I'll just be forever grateful to him for that. He's not only, you know, representing Focus Bikes and works with me professionally, but he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, that's great. So that we're back up to this, what else, you know, you're talking about this leap of faith even more so than starting your own law practice for starting your own team. Just take us through what exactly went down for you to do that.
Oh man, it was like scrambling to find the names of the person who, you know, works here at this company that handles this. Just it's a moving target. I mean, like gathering sponsorship for bike racing is a moving target. It's like you got every connection 1 year and then everybody changes jobs and works at a different company. And now you're like right back to square one. It almost feels like a game of like whisper down the alley. Cause you're like, hey, where's this guy working now? Is this guy still at Giro? No, he's over here at Crank Brothers, but you can, you know, it's just like, you can't keep track. Like it's just, you can't keep track. And so Jeff really kind of like became my like center point for, or my springboard for like, okay, you know, like who can you direct me to for physique and who can you direct me to, you know, for Giro and things like that. And it was just sort of like a lot of nights, like I would come home from work and then I'd train and spend from like 8 or 9 at night till midnight, like putting digital media together to send out resumes and send out like PDF presentations and writing emails and, you know, keeping track of who I'm trying to reach and how many times I've emailed them. Cause you have to be really persistent. And it was some seriously stressful moments of like, well, I have bikes, but I don't have wheels and these are disc bikes. So I have no wheels right now. And I don't have money to buy any wheels cause I don't have a team budget. So what am I going to do? You know, like that kind of stuff. And it was stressful for a while. Fortunately, I live pretty close to Trexlertown and the velodrome there. And there's a lot of really great people there. And I've made some connections. I do a training race there every week. And so Bill Strickland of Bicycling Magazine is there. So he's helped me out. And he's a great guy. Very funny. So it's just these little contacts along the way of meeting people and hoping that you can string a program together to like piecemeal it to make it through the season. I mean, cash wise, I had to kind of put my own money into it. I did have some cash sponsors, but not, you know, just a bare minimum, like just enough to get me from point A to point B.
Right.
I recycled all of my prize money to keep going. So my goal, and I'm fortunate because I have a different, you know, like a different profession. So my goal is to just end the season not having it cost me anything. I'm not trying to make money on it.
Sure.
So yeah. As long as I break even, that's a victory to me. And I've been able to do that now. And actually, I did have a surplus both years. So I just sort of recycled that into the next season.
So 2014, first year of what was then PB2,
yep,
pro cycling.
Mm-hmm.
Headed over to Europe in December. Did you not race Worlds in 2014? 14, 15? Okay.
I didn't in 15. No, it was between Crystal Anthony and I, and we both knew it.
Okay.
And we were like on pins and needles, waiting to see who it was going to be. And I came back from Nationals, and I was down in Philadelphia waiting for the call. And I was like checking my email. And then Crystal called me before I saw the email. And I'm like, hello. And she's like, I got it. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, I'm really sorry. I'm like, don't apologize. Like, that's the way it goes. Like, I'm happy you're going. That's great.
Yeah. So this year, first off, let's just talk about you were PB2 Pro Cycling, changed the name to Level 11 Racing. What's the story behind the team name change?
I was asking for more money, basically, to be the title sponsor, and we weren't really getting it. And again, like I waited too long. I snoozed a little bit too much on getting going for this, getting the funds and stuff to get going for this past season. And so I sort of took the Jeremy Powers approach of, well, you know, like this is how much it would cost to be a title sponsor. So either someone puts that up or I'm got my own team name. And so I sort of like looked at that model and was like, yeah, maybe I'll do that because I can stay locked to a name for a longer period of time. And then just sort of, so I could have at least that team recognition.
Is it a Spinal Tap reference?
It is.
Nice. Okay. Good.
But it wasn't me that came up with that, actually. So my partner is also my teammate, Rachel Rubino, and sure. she actually was going to be racing 3-4, and the intent was she was going to be my mechanic because that's what she does for work, at a bike shop, and it kind of backfired because she trained with me all summer, and then
so
really beat everybody in the 3-4 races.
Wait, so beginning of 2015, she was still a 3-4?
Yeah.
Wow. And then she was racing in Europe by the end of last year?
Uh-huh.
That's amazing. That is great. I'm going to have to talk to Rachel too.
Yeah. And so we were like, well, what do we name this team? What are we going to do? And she came up with a bunch of names, and she's a musician. I think you know that actually.
Yeah.
And yes. So she was like, Level 11. That's amazing. I'm like, that's cool. I didn't actually know that. Truthfully, I did not know.
Well, that's what I was. That's why I had to ask. I was like, I don't know if that's really up Arlie's alley, but.
No, that was all Rachel's alley.
That's amazing.
100%. But there's actually quite a few people who know this. We just were communicating with Feedback Sports for next season, and Katie emailed us and was like, is that a Spinal Tap thing? So. It's like a good conversation.
Well,
Katie
is one of my favorite people, so that doesn't surprise me that she got that.
Yep. Yeah, it was awesome. So yeah, but yeah, Rachel was in the racing 3-4. That was really the intent was for her to upgrade by like mid-season, and there was no chance that was happening. She went to Nittany and like won by a lot, and I was like, well, the first race of the season, I was like, well, I guess I need a new mechanic in the pit. This is not going to work out. So
yeah, but even. You know, on a more sour note, while she's having this rise last season, you're sort of going through some physical troubles that sort of derailed most of your season, would you say? And what was going on? And, you know, what did you have to figure out to get through that?
Well, I came into this year, this past season, super strong in August. Because I was a little bit on the warpath to like redeem. I was so close to making worlds in 15 and was like, well, I have to do that again this year. Like, so we trained super hard, and my coach, Mike Berner, and I worked really hard in August, and my numbers were great and everything was right where it needed to be. And then the first race of the season at Rochester, I got into a crash less than a minute into the race and endoed really hard and never unclipped out of my pedals, out of either pedal, which is pretty remarkable, and just smashed my left hip into, basically we were going like downhill, but there was a side hill on my left, so that my hip impacted the ground on that side hill first, and it tore my labrum in my hip, but I didn't know that, so I got up and immediately was like, I mean, that crash like really rang my bell. Like I was had to kind of shake it off and like reorient myself. And I knew right away my left leg didn't feel right, but it didn't hurt. It just didn't feel right. Like I didn't have any power coming out of it. And so I dropped out of the race, started the next day, dropped out again. But I was going to the World Cup in Vegas like in less than a week. About a week. So I knew I had to keep racing. I wasn't injured enough to not be able to do it. So it was just sort of like, well, we're going to take some time, you know, and race Nittany and then go to Vegas and just see, you know, try to make it work. And raced Nittany and had like a total hip, like back, like all my muscles just like seized in my back. And I had to be like carried away from the finish line because I couldn't move.
Well, yeah, but the crazy thing there and what must have been frustrating is at least day two Nittany, you finished fourth.
Day one.
Oh, it was day one?
Yeah, and then day two is when like it all went
okay
to hell.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. But it's like you're hurt, yet you're still being able to, you know, get the result you wanted, but at least still be up there. So you're probably not thinking it's as serious as it may be.
Right. Right. And that was exactly it. It was like, well, something's wrong, but I'm not really sure what. And I can function, but not perfectly. But so what do? Do we like take time off? So I didn't really train at all between Rochester and Nittany and Vegas. Like it was just like race and rest. And that was it. Knowing that we could carry fitness over from August and it would be okay. But I just had this like my groin would get really tight and then my hip flexor would get really tight and then it would creep around in my lower back and it was like excruciating to ride a bike. Like I would be racing and all I wanted to do was just get off of the bike and like lay down on the ground. Like I needed to get out of that position and I didn't really know what any of that meant. So I started changing my position. We still focused on like trying to take more time off and like nothing was working because, again, I was scheduled to go to Valkenburg for the World Cup in October. And, you know, the flights were booked and everything was ready to go. I paid for everything. So it's like, you know, what's the worst that can happen at this point? I don't have an injury that, like, I'm going to break something. So I think I can just try it. I think I can do it. And it got to the point where I'd be okay for like two laps. And then like, it would be like a total shutdown. Like my whole left leg would just like shut down and I couldn't pedal. And the guy that works for me in Belgium, Greg Germer, he runs the Chainstay. He was working in the pit for me. And he's like, did you start to hurt, you know, like two and a half laps in? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, yeah, I could see it. Like it was visible. Like there was a visible difference in your body language and your speed and everything. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what to do about it. So I had a terrible result there. I mean, I was like 30th or something. And the year before that I was 11th. Right. So it was a real disappointment.
That's the type of course, you know, especially it's sort of that mountain bike S course that seems like you would excel on.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it has a lot of elevation. It's super challenging, and it was really fun this year actually because it was even more technical than it had been. So it was really fun, but it's just so mentally taxing when like your body's just not doing what you know it can do, and you don't know what's wrong. So I came back and went to the doctor, and a couple of people had suggested like it sounds like you have a torn labrum, and I went to an orthopedic doctor and he took an MRI at the end of October and he's like, yeah, you've got a torn labrum. And I'm like, well, now what? And he's like, well, you should rest and we're going to put you on, you know, some major anti-inflammatories to try to get all the muscles around it to chill out because that's a bulk of your problem. You have an injury and you're compensating. And he didn't think it was bad enough to need surgery. So I just didn't do anything for like 3 weeks.
Well,
took off entirely.
Yeah, except you know, out of nostalgia, you were nice enough to race at DCCX for one day.
I did because it was really hard. It was really hard to be in the pit. Although I will tell you what, being in the pit is so much more stressful than racing bikes.
Yeah,
I was like, I stood in the pit with Aaron Selman, and I was like, this is wild in here. Like wild things go on in here. No wonder all the mechanics want to drink when they're done. This is nuts. But yeah, because Rachel was going to race and like it was a good opportunity for her to maybe net some UCI points. And I've I've got a really good friend down there and I love visiting with them. So it was, and I love DCCX. So like, it was all like very fun for me to do, even though I was obviously quite hindered by my injury.
So, you know, that day accepted, it looks like, from Valkenburg, October 18th. And then you took 3 weeks off and then came back for Supercross.
Yeah. And so I really hadn't done any training like prior to Supercross, and I just went. Because at this point, I had to move into damage control mode. I was hemorrhaging UCI points left and right. I mean, I started the season ranked in like 28th or something, or 25th, and was very securely in the top 50. And I was very, very quickly losing all of that. And so Mike and I had talked again about, like, you know, ran the numbers, and I had won the year before. And it was like, I have to go because I have to get some kind of points out of that race. And it's a lessly attended race, like a more sparsely attended race. So I'm like, well, what's the worst that can happen? Like, I have to do it. And day one went well for me because it was really technical. It was really muddy and slippery. And so I didn't have to put down the same kind of like race power that I normally would. But it's still, you know, I still didn't feel good. And then day two, it was less muddy, more power. And I had lost so much fitness because I really hadn't trained at all since the end of August, really, at that point. And I was like redlined, like feeling like I was going to throw up. I mean, I haven't felt that taxed in a cross race in a really long time. So that was a pretty big eye opener of like, wow, you're in a different space right now.
Yeah, no, that must have been. Yeah. So that, even uninjured, taking that time off probably put you, you know, in fitness wise, probably helped a ton. And then that sort of set you up and you got back into it, sort of having a good end of the season. And then you went back to Europe and everything just went kind of crazy.
Yeah. I mean, so like I had been getting like pretty mediocre results and enough to be able to like hang to go to Belgium. I mean, I had that opportunity. I had the financial support to do it again. The chainstay in Oudenaarde with Greg Germer, you know, he's like really great to work with and great deal to go stay there and use his facilities. So it was like, well, I got to go because I went last year. I can't hemorrhage more points. Like, it was all about points. It became really, that was the only driving force at this point. And so it was sort of like, keep taking anti-inflammatories to be able to race the bike so you don't lose points. And that was the game for a long time. And so, yeah, we went to Belgium and so this was sort of like my own oversight. There were races going on in Texas that I didn't know about because they had never been on the schedule before and I wasn't paying that close of attention. And so I thought that I had covered all the contingencies about who's moving in and out of the top 50, not realizing that there were two back-to-back weekends of UCI racing in Texas that were again pretty sparsely attended. And Ellie Anderson and I were both over in Belgium. Neither one of us had sort of accounted for this potential contingency. So we were given the green light for a Namur and Zolder by USA Cycling. And we get over there, we race no more. And then that's when sort of everything fell apart because we realized that these races happened in Texas and this moved people up in the top 50. This bumped people out of the top 50. And so a thing that no one considered was the deadline for World Cups is a different date than the eligibility. So you have to be registered for World Cup, I think, 7 days prior or something like that. And a UCI point list came out after that. And so that would make certain people ineligible. So by being registered, you weren't safe. You could still be bumped if you fell out of the top 50. And no one really had considered that at the UCI, I don't think.
No, and especially since, you know, even if it happened, I've talked to Amanda Nauman a lot, and, you know, she was one of the people that was working really hard to get into that top 50 and, you know, not knowing or really thinking about the consequences of this weird scheduling thing that was going on the other side. And no, it's a bad system because, you know, what I was going to say is that if you're living in France and you get knocked out of eligibility, it stinks and you can't race, but you haven't spent thousands of dollars to go across the, you know, ocean and get a flight and spend all this money and then not be able to race. You just stay at home and don't race and don't make that drive. So, yeah. Do you know if there's been any talk about changing that rule?
I mean, I actually had communications with the UCI and with Helen Wyman about it when it was happening to be like, look, you know, what do we do about this? I mean, it was mind blowing to me, especially because as a lawyer, my job is to, especially doing estate planning and things like that, my job is to look very far ahead at the potential contingencies for what's going to happen. And it's not that anybody can see every potential contingency, but to me, what happened to Ellie and I was a thing that really someone should have foreseen that being a consequence before it actually affected somebody. And so I think both of us were in this position of like, well, hey, like what do we do now? Like we were told we were in, you can't revoke entry after you tell somebody they're in and they just weren't, they were staking hard and fast to that top 50 rule. I know Helen was going to address it. I have not heard any updates about it, but her intention was to address it at the Cross Commission in February. And so I know those things sort of evolve between February and the beginning of the cross season. So, you know, hopefully it will be addressed. I mean, I think having a point list come out every Tuesday is maybe not the best solution because anyone could get bumped essentially on a Tuesday, no matter where. So we were originally looking at this like, well, this is a back-to-back race weekend scenario. Like you never have World Cups back-to-back weekends when really the issue is, it's the Tuesday release of the points list, because that means that anyone's in, you know, that 50th person is in danger of falling out of the top 50 that Tuesday before the World Cup on Sunday, every time there's a World Cup. So no one can plan for that. The travel to me is ancillary. I think the bigger issue is if you're looking to field a complete team at a World Cup, you can't be expected to do that if suddenly people are going to get bumped on the Tuesday, you know, 5 days prior. Because I'm sure that would apply for anybody. Even if you're only driving to the World Cup, your training is based around peaking for a World Cup.
Right,
so like,
right.
You're not going to get your best people in there if they don't know they're racing. And so I looked at it from the perspective of a World Cup is meant for the best people in the world to be at. And are we getting that by the way we're implementing these rules? You know, maybe not. And so I hope they take a closer look at it because it's going to impact more people in greater ways if we don't sort of change it and get ahead of it now at this point. Because my point to the UCI when this was happening was, well, now you're taking two Americans out of this race once, but we were already registered and we were already given the green light. The people who can fill this spot can't make it here because you're giving them 5 days notice. And even if they can make it here, they're not planning for it.
Right.
So the World Cup is, we're scored individually, but we're also scored as a nation. And so that becomes a detriment to the nation ranking, because now we can't field our whole team because you're changing the rules 5 days before the game.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they definitely, well, hopefully there'll be some changes, because that was an unfortunate situation all the way around, you know. And I know you're saying the travel's ancillary, but also just having you all there and then not being able to race was that sort of stunk.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. I mean, I got to go watch and it was, I was, you know, it was helpful. I wanted to make it a point to be standing in places for the women where I could give them feedback that, you know, we would normally get in an American race because we've got American fans that want to tell us what place you're in, how many seconds back you are. And so I got to do that. And so that gave me some peace of mind about it, because I was still involved and helpful. And, you know, like they were all the ladies were really appreciative of me being there. So it was still pretty cool.
Sure. So going into the coming year, you know, what are you looking forward to? You're 32 years old, which
I am.
Yeah. Women's cyclocross. I mean, you're sort of in that prime, you know, so it's not like, You, what am I trying to say? Not like you're on the downslide, Arlie. So how's it going? How, well, one thing that, you know, sort of working into that, one thing that I know about you that may be different from other people in how they train is that you're not only riding a bike when you train. You do everything, lift weights. I saw you in there doing like almost CrossFit type stuff. So what do you put into your training that may be different from your typical cyclist, and how do you think that helps you in meeting your goals?
Well, one thing I've started doing is I started racing road and mountain bikes in the summer road meaning crits, basically. I'm not doing any road racing, but crit racing. So doing like the NRC, NCC crits, the ones that are within a reasonable travel distance, and hitting some of the mass series mountain bike races. Because I think those two disciplines really complement cyclocross in different ways. And so I can kind of sharpen my technical skills and the kind of fitness that comes with mountain biking, along with the sharpness that you get sharpened in crits. And so that's my plan for the summer. I do go to the gym twice a week, and do basically a pretty much a CrossFit style workout. Again, a good friend of mine owns this gym. It's called Dedicated Fitness, and it's in my hometown. And her and I have been working together for like since I was in high school. And so I do that twice a week, and I love it. And I like it. It's super helpful for cyclocross in many ways because it gives me a more dynamic fitness, a more like multidimensional fitness than I would get from just riding bikes. But I also just like it. Mondays, I don't ride bikes at all, and it's a rest day, but I go to the gym every Monday, and like I consider that to be a rest day because it's a workout, but it's also really fun, and I get to do it with my friends, you know, my non-bike racing friends. So it's cool, and it gives me like a different kind of challenge. So we're always doing making up wild stuff. Like, did you see that ring push-up?
I did. That's what I was thinking about when I asked it. Yeah.
Yeah, we like to like make things up, and fortunately, nobody's gotten hurt yet. But sometimes we probably, you know, I'm 32, so I can't really go overboard with it as I used to. But yeah, I do that gym stuff pretty much until the end of September. So we carry it through 1 month of the cross season, and then I sort of like I don't do any gym stuff, and then I kind of like as the training ramps up, I sort of like burn off that muscle and then lean out by nationals so that I'm like still carrying the same power, but a little bit less weight. And so it seems to have worked out really well. And getting creative with some workouts to help with running in mud and those sort of weird aspects of cyclocross that are really hard to replicate in any other way, really.
So coming into this season, do you still feel like you have something to prove, or what are you looking to get out of 2016 cyclocross season?
Well, I have hemorrhaged so much points that I'm way out of the top 50 now. I'm like down to like 66. And so this makes me not eligible for the World Cups that are going to happen in September here. And that has been a challenging concept because it's just really disappointing. And so I'm wrapping my brain around that idea. And which is good because it makes me, you know, have to work on my mental game a little bit more. But the first part of the season is really going to be driven on getting points back. I mean, I've lost so many that I really can only go up at this point. So that's the silver lining. But it's going to be really focused on that and just getting myself back in the top 50 so I can still resume World Cup, racing. And so I've still got some stuff going on with my hip. I'm not 100% yet. While my race results have been really good and the numbers have been quite good, I still have some symptoms that I'm trying to work out. I've been seeing a doctor now at UPenn to sort of try to figure out what exactly is going on, because we're not 100% sure that it is related to the labrum tear. It may be something else. I wouldn't say that it's limiting at this point, but it's still present. And so I would like to be able to narrow down what it is exactly so right. I can speak about it more specifically and be able to do something to sort of get it to not be I just sort of have like this persistent like achiness that I can't really get rid of. And so that's what we're trying to figure out. And it's only when riding a bike. I don't experience it at the gym. And so that's why this is sort of mysterious at this point. Yeah. So hoping to get that sorted out to make sure that's not going on next cross season. And yeah, it's just going to be the points game, getting back into that top 50. I mean, I think based on how I'm riding right now, I'm going quite well. And I think we're taking a little bit of a different approach to training this winter and or spring. So I'm pretty optimistic that if everything goes okay and I don't, you know, don't have any other setbacks, that I can probably come back even stronger this year than I was last year. I think the time off has actually been a little bit of a benefit because I'm not coming into the season, this training season, with fatigue like I would if I raced the whole cross season. So we'll see what it does.
Yeah. Last topic I just wanted to touch on is you've been an outspoken proponent of just equality in sport and in cyclocross and cycling, you know, through all the disciplines, mainly in pay and conditions and everything else. Just, is there anything that's, you know, on your mind right now in that area? How do you think, from where we started a number of years ago to today, how have things progressed and what would you like to see in the future?
I mean, I think it's coming along quite nicely. I mean, Helen Wyman's been doing like amazing things with the Cross Commission, and she's just been really, really persistent in Europe to sort of show up and be like, hey, like the way you're doing this is wrong, and I'm going to tell you how you should do it, and I'm going to work really hard to make sure you do it. And that's great because we really need that kind of advocate, especially overseas. You know, the disparity in prize money overseas is still pretty significant, but it's improving at a really good pace. So that makes me feel better about it. And even domestically, you know, like we've made some pretty big strides every year. I mean, I think the numbers are just speaking for themselves. Like we have women who just keep coming to cyclocross, and we keep selling out fields, and we keep showing up. And so promoters can't really make that argument anymore that women don't come and we don't have the same numbers. Like it's not true anymore. And I think that's coming from a grassroots campaign of we're going to do clinics and we're going to do, you know, like all of these things to bring new women into the sport. I mean, that Redline bike, that my first cyclocross bike ever, is now a loaner bike in Philadelphia. A lady down there wanted to make a loaner bike for people to use to be able to try cyclocross. And I had that frame still kicking around in the basement. And I was like, here, take this, build it up. And they loan that out to people to race every week.
That's
the local
great.
Races down there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And there's bicycle therapy in Philadelphia has been putting together some loaner bike programs with Specialized. So they have loaner road bikes, cross bikes, and mountain bikes that they're in small sizes so that women can go there and try this stuff out. And it's those little things that catch fire. So, you know, Sophia did this, like she calls it the Rocky bike. That's my red line. That, you know, like led to this thing at Bicycle Therapy, which is leading to all of these other programs. And we're going to be doing more clinics down in Philadelphia. And I've done one every summer, and we cap it at 50 women and it gets sold out. Like we can't have more than 50 in that section of the park. And we cap it at 50 and we've had a full field. So like that kind of stuff is building the community, and it's just because women are passionate about getting other women involved in it. So all those ideas catch fire really quick, and that's what we need to be recognized that, hey, we're here and we want to come to your races. So like, let's give us incentive to do it. And I think that's really cool. Cyclocross is a really accessible discipline of bike racing too. It's probably the least intimidating. And so I think that's helpful also. And the atmosphere is still really awesome. I mean, like everybody likes to hang out at cross races. So it's the perfect mix of factors to make it really successful. So as long as ladies are getting out there and helping other women get into the sport, then it's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger, and promoters aren't going to be able to ignore that fact anymore.
Perfect. Cool. Well, Arlie, thank you so much for, talking to me today, and I guess I will probably see you at Nittany and then Charm City for the C1, which will be pretty awesome.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, I'm sure I'll probably catch you before then.
Yes.
At some event, somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, good luck with your races coming up and also with the continued success in your law practice. I think, you know, I know I've said it to you before, but I think it's awesome that you're able to do that full time and pursue that and also pursue a professional level athletic career. So congratulations on both of those pursuits.
Yes, thank you very, very much.
All right, so there you have it. That was R. Lee Kemmerer. Thanks for tuning in to Crosshairs Radio. As always, if you want to get in touch, please send me an email at feedback@cxhairs.com. Also, follow along at cxhairs on Twitter. Go to wideanglepodium.com. Support the shows, become a member, and we will see you here next week for the next episode of Crosshairs Radio. Later on.